navigation guiding them. Ted took the lead. The thousands of years of erosion since volcanic activity had laid down this stone jungle had melted a few of the sharpest edges and brought some vegetation, but the rocks were still treacherous. The mix of sizes and the crevices between the stones forced Bernie to keep her eyes down rather than look up at the clouds building in the turquoise winter sky. Islands of trees and shrubs had formed where the mechanics of geography allowed for the creation of soil and retention of water. Periodically, Ted stopped and checked his compass and the GPS to make sure they were headed in the right direction. When they paused for water, Bernie said, "Why does the lava look so different from place to place? I mean, this area where we've been walking isn't much like what I saw with Wings and Roots." Ted glanced up from his GPS. "Several different volcanic eruptions created this area. The McCarty's lava flow is only 3,000 years old, one of the newest in the United States, excepting Mount St. Helens in Hawaii, of course." They hiked on. Bernie enjoyed the cool, fresh air, the rhythm of the trail, the good luck of being out of the car and out of the office on a semi-mild December day. She told herself to focus on that and not what lay at the end of the hike. About the time she was seriously considering a drink from her water bottle, Ted paused, studying the rocks ahead. His voice had a deeper degree of confidence. "I remember that ridge with all the lichens. We don't have far now." They stopped again a few minutes later, and he motioned Bernie up next to him. "You see where that juniper is growing up against the lava?" She nodded. "Look up at the top of the tree, and then take a straight line to the right. Follow that ridge line."
"Is that the cave?"
"Yes. Ready to see what's in there?"
"In a minute. I want to ask you some questions."
Ted lowered himself onto a relatively flat piece of rock and nodded. "Ask away." Bernie sat across from him.
"Give me an idea of what to expect."
He twirled the end of his mustache with one hand and told her about what he assumed were rib bones and some human vertebrae. "Whatever or whoever is up there predates our version of the Southwest by a long, long time. It felt, I don't know how to describe it, creepy, I guess, uncomfortable, and I've been in a lot of caves."
"Did you touch anything?"
He cleared his throat. "No way."
"The incident commander told my boss that you noticed something in the cave besides the bones."
"It looked like dried buckskin, maybe an old bag. To be honest, I didn't spend a lot of time looking. I figured it might have some spiritual significance, and I knew it wasn't any of my business." He spoke with an intensity that surprised her. Bernie looked toward the cave.
"Thank you. I'll take a look now."
"Do you need an extra flashlight?"
"I'm fine."
She had double-checked to make sure hers worked. He slipped off his backpack, unzipped the big pocket, and handed her a pair of rubber knee pads. "You'll need these. Do you want me to go with you?"
"No, I won't be long."
"Do you have your gloves?"
"I think so."
Bernie took the pads and hiked to the entrance, saying a prayer for protection as she approached. As in the cave Annie had found, the lava boulders someone had placed to block access had been shoved away, another confirmation that this might be a burial, and worse, a burial that had been looted. She climbed over the last of the rocks and paused to stare into the darkness. She took off her backpack, removed the flashlight from her duty belt, and put on the knee pads and her gloves. She inhaled deeply, feeling the cold air at the tip of her nose, and looked up at the sky, now filled with towering gray storm clouds. Then she squatted down and slowly let the beam of light explore the cave's interior as her eyes adjusted to the darkness. At first, she saw nothing except the dark rock she'd expected. She moved the light slowly, and then the beam glanced off something lighter in color. She focused on it, but couldn't be sure what she was seeing. Bernie lowered herself to her hands and knees and began to inch inside, shining the light directly in front of her, looking for relatively smooth places on the lava to spare her hands. She moved forward a little more, stopping to shine the light into the darkness. The roof of the cave seemed to get closer, the space tighter. Her chest tightened too.
She crawled deeper inside. And then she saw something. A bone, varnished to a deep yellow with the patina of age. It did indeed look human. She adjusted to squatting, the top of her head brushing the cold roof of the cave. Slowly she ran the light along the shaft of the bone, discovering another bone, and then a small grouping, like part of an assembly-required life-size skeleton puzzle. A cluster of small turquoise beads lay next to the bones, probably from jewelry buried with this poor soul. She continued on the same trajectory, stopping when her light found fragments of broken pottery. Perhaps the looter had dropped the bowl, or one of the old ones might have broken it years before when they respectfully interred the body. Whatever ceremonial jars, fiber mats, and other artifacts had been placed here to help the deceased on the final journey were long gone. Pushing aside the clenching in her stomach and the rapid pounding of her heart, she crawled closer to the old bones, searching thoroughly. There, next to what could be part of a human pelvis, she saw what Ted had described. The strand of what looked like leather and the gray feathers might indicate that the person buried here was a Hatasi, but Bernie's intuition said otherwise. Whoever this skeleton had once been, she deduced, probably wore those items as part of the burial garb. Exhaling to calm herself, she turned around and put the flashlight to work on a final scan before she left this sad, desecrated place. The stone floor of the cave kept its secrets, but she noticed some pockets of sand and another broken bead, one that could be shell. Then the beam reflected off a jawbone, clearly a human mandible, yellowed with age. Bernie dropped the flashlight, which rolled away from her, toward the mouth of the cave. She followed on hands and knees, oblivious now to the rough stones that penetrated the leather on her gloves. As she grabbed for the flashlight, she realized that the cold had stiffened her fingers to near uselessness. Pushing herself to sitting, she pressed her frozen hands between her thighs. Finally, her fingers regained their flexibility, and she crawled back toward the skull. Even though it bothered her, she had to finish the job. She pulled her phone from the jacket pocket and took off her gloves so she could turn on the camera flash. She needed pictures of everything here, the other bones, the beads, and the leather and feathers, to show the Cultural Preservation Office staff. Finally, she started back down the slope to where Ted waited. He stood when he saw her approach.
"I was about to go up and holler for you. That took a while."
"I needed photos. There's no doubt in my mind that you found human bones, old bones. I'll tell the Cultural Preservation Office about this." The wind made a noise in the trees, and she looked up. On the rocks above the cave, she saw something skitter. Smiling at her own hyper-attentiveness, she was about to turn away when she noticed something else. A spiral pecked into the rock. Ted was starting to put his pack back on, but Bernie motioned for him to stop. "Could you help me with something?"
"Sure."
"We need to do some hauling."
"I'm not following you."
"Someone removed the rocks that protected the entrance, the boulders the old ones had piled up to keep the burial private."
"I'll do it."
Normally, she would have argued, but she'd already spent enough time in the presence of the dead. "Thanks. I appreciate it." After he'd finished moving the rocks, Ted led the way back to the search base camp. "Do you spend much time out in the lava?" she asked as they walked.
"I did as a kid. My uncle had a ranch near here, the Manzanares spread. Maybe you've heard of it."
"I met an officer named Manzanares. He works for the New Mexico State Police out of Grants, at least for a little while longer. He's getting ready to retire."
"I know who you mean. He's my cousin. He looks after the place now. I haven't been back to the ranch since he's been in charge."
The tone in his voice said that it wasn't for lack of interest. "Why not?"
"Let's just say I don't feel welcome."
Ted's radio squawked, the transmission loud enough for Bernie to overhear.
The vultures Fred and Liz spotted were enjoying a deer, Kat said. Mr. Cruz is still missing. The search will resume at dawn, depending on the weather. Head on in, everyone, and thank you.
Ted turned his radio to broadcast.
Officer Manuelito verifies ancient human remains. We blocked the cave, and I will give you the coordinates. No sign of Mr. Cruz. Save me some dinner.
Bernie thought the hike back seemed faster, perhaps because her anxiety about viewing the body was gone now. At base camp, she reported to Katz, stressing that the site needed to remain off-limits to the search teams. The cook invited her to join the rest of the crew to finish a stew they had made for the volunteers' lunch. She took a bowl and found a quiet spot to eat before her drive home. She was nearly done when a slim Navajo man with black-framed glasses came over to her.
Are you Officer Manuelito?
That's me.
I'm Franklin, the one you talked to on the phone about Dom.
He looked like a well-dressed cowboy, complete with a handsome leather jacket, not the image she'd created to go with the understated voice on the phone. He was slim in the hips, broad of shoulder, the same build as Chi. He switched to Navajo and gave her his clans. Bernie reciprocated. They weren't related, but he was related to Chi through the paternal grandmother's elder brother.
Have you heard anything from Dom?
She asked.
I wish. I check my messages whenever I can, thinking maybe this is only a mistake, and now that he's had a chance to think things over, he's on his way home. If he's still alive, I think he would at least want me to know he's safe. I mean, if he is safe.
Franklin turned away. When he turned back, his emotions were under control.
I wanted to thank you for caring.
She thought about saying she was only doing her job, but she realized he was correct. She did care. Franklin had started to walk away. When she called after him, he turned to face her, the fringe on his jacket swaying like the mane of a well-groomed horse. She motioned to him to sit with her.
Join me here a minute, and tell me about Dom.
He sat next to her, and she breathed in the faint fragrance of his hair gel.
Domingo is the nicest man in the whole world. You know about all the work he does with kids, giving them hope, building them up, changing their lives.
Bernie nodded.
Well, he likes to cook for us, and does the shopping, too. This situation, him disappearing, it's terrifying.
Franklin clenched his long fingers together, then straightened them again.
I'm so worried I can't think straight.
It is terrifying. Do you know of anyone who might want to hurt him?
Bernie waited, but Franklin seemed to need prompting.
Did he have any enemies?
Dom gets along with everybody. That's how he can put up with me, I guess.
He chuckled, and she thought he was about to add something, but he changed the subject.
He loves his sister, but she drives him crazy, telling him what to do, where to be, how to act, rubbing it in that she's his big sister because she's a few minutes older. But he's still sweet to her. You know that they're twins.
I know.
I think she's jealous of me, of what Dom and I have together. Maybe she's still upset because she ended up as a widow. Of course, everyone knows that Roger wanted to divorce her. If that had happened, she probably would be living in a tent somewhere, not in that nice house.
I heard she planned to divorce him.
Franklin stood.
It doesn't matter now. I shouldn't gossip. I've got to help clean up. Thank you for suggesting that I volunteer out here. It sure is better than pacing around our place. I was useless at work, but this helps.
Franklin headed off. Bernie took her stew bowl to the washstand and walked to her unit, thinking about what Franklin had said. If Dom had met with foul play, those closest to him would be the obvious suspects. He'd wanted to say something else about their relationship, and then he'd pulled back. She slid across the icy seat of her unit, started the engine, and as soon as the temperature gauge moved a micron off the sea, switched on the heater. She'd seen enough old bones these past few days to last a lifetime. She thought again about Franklin. Maybe he was worth another conversation, if Dom wasn't found soon. 16. Jim Chi considered himself a patient man, but even his patience had its limits, and the women in his life seemed to know exactly how far to stretch those boundaries. Take his sweet Bernie, too busy to answer his calls. At least she sent an I love you text. But he wanted more. Or Darlene, not usually the silent type, adamantly refusing to tell him how she got that large, ugly bruise on her arm. And now he was growing frustrated because of four other women. George Curley's mother Deborah and his wife Caitlin, who seemed nice but not very assertive. Mrs. Vigil, who was more worried about the new truck than her wandering son-in-law. And the mysterious Juanita, who was sitting in the studio in stony silence. Dealing with a flat tire, an ex-con, a husband on the lam, and a suspicious character who should be dead was easier by far. After their discussion about his birth certificate and the bona fides of his associate, Chi had more questions for C.S., but decided to hold them. Several might be better answered with Darlene there, too. So he sat, first listening to C.S. explain, at considerable length, why the music from the band Herbert's nephew played in would not be right for the video, how music provides texture for a video but should not dominate unless the subject is the music itself, or something like that. Herbert countered with,
"But he's family, man. He needs a break. He can use the money."
She texted Darlene twice and got a thumbs up and a smiley face in response. He enjoyed the lazy warmth of the studio building and the cozy chair. A nap wouldn't be bad. A little snooze. He closed his eyes and tuned out C.S.'s lecture, but his brain began to churn up what he had to do before he could really call it a day. After he dealt with C.S. and Darlene, he needed to walk back to the dorm, change the tire on his truck, drive to the motel and pack up so he could head home to Shiprock and his, no, their, trailer. He'd ask if the Cibola County deputy in the class knew anything about George Curley, an unlikely possibility, or about a rancher out there hiring workers in November. Then he'd call Caitlin once more to see if she'd heard from George, or had any other ideas about where he could be. It would be wonderful to listen to the song of the San Juan River, and to hear Bernie's gentle breathing in place of rap music. He had almost given in to grogginess when his phone buzzed with a call. He looked at the number and turned to C.S.
"I have to take this. It's Bernie."
He stood up and walked to the far end of the room. "We'll be in the studio." Juanita stood too, but Herbert blocked her.
"You're not welcome here. Go home. You know it's over between us."
"You found someone else? You stinking..."
Chi turned away from the rat.
"Sweetheart."
"Hi, glad I found you."
"It's great to hear your voice, but you sound tired."
"Oh, it's work."
"What's happening with the search in the Malpais?"
"Cruz is still out there somewhere. The weather is predicted to change for the worse."
She told him about the second cave.
"I want to hear about Santa Fe and the training."
Her tone of voice changed.
"But first, have you seen my sister tonight?"
"I have. We had dinner with her roommate, and I took them both back to the dorm, and she gave me a tour. I'm waiting for her now at C.S.'s studio."
He didn't bother Bernie with the beer cans and the bruise.
"Want me to ask her to call you?"
"No, but would you call me and then hand the phone to her?"
"You sound aggravated."
"You must be psychic."
The sound of her laughter lit up his day for a moment.
"I have some loose ends to tie up here, but I can't wait to head home. Don't forget to call when sister gets there. Use my cell number."
"Sure thing. It's good to hear your voice. I thought you were mad at me or something."
"Only too busy. I miss you."
And she ended the call. A loud knock distracted him, and he turned toward the sound.
"I'll get it."
Darlene rushed in, her cheeks red with cold. She spoke softly.
Wait here a minute. I need to tell you something. Darlene kept her voice low, too.
What now?
Bernie is upset about something. She asked me to call her and then put you on the line.
Fine, don't stress over it. Give me a minute.
Darlene unbuttoned her coat.
Who's Herbert arguing with?
A woman named Juanita.
Juanita?
You know her? 30-something, on the hefty side.
I haven't met her, but he's been talking about her like she's seriously evil. Holy smokes, Juanita came looking for him.
Darlene sighed.
I'm ready. Go ahead and call sister.
Bernie picked up on the first ring this time.
She's there?
Hi, sweetheart. I'm with Darlene.
You're special, Jim Chi. Let me talk to her.
He handed the phone to Darlene, who rolled her eyes.
Hello, what's up?
After that, she seemed to be listening. She left the sisters to figure out whatever they needed to figure out. The signature aroma of marijuana drifted toward him as he walked to the studio, and he heard a racket from the open door. Juanita's voice dominated.
That little creep made you God!
I don't make the rules, C.S. said, but you can't smoke in the building, and you especially can't smoke weed in here.
I've got a medical card. Wanna hit?
Well, Chi thought, I need to step in and be the bad guy. But then he heard Herbert's voice. Baby, put that joint out and pay attention. We're done, you and me. You bully me, you don't listen. You've got an attitude and you won't help me stay straight. That guy, Tall Navajo? Well, he's a real cop, not an actor in the movie. Juanita laughed.
Is that right?
Right. Chi walked into the room as he spoke and grabbed the joint from her hand. He extinguished it with a pinch before she could protest and dropped it on the floor. Leave now before I detain you. Call security and you end up in jail. The woman put her hands on her broad hips. She gave C.S. a dark look, Chi a darker one, and stared at Herbert a long moment. Then she bent down, picked up the smashed joint, pulled a plastic bag out of her pocket, and stowed it there.
You ain't done with me, Clyde Herbert. You'll see.
She turned and stomped toward the door. C.S. said, As soon as Darlene gets here, we'll start. I'll make sure.
I'm here.
Darlene approached from the hall, her voice strained, and handed Chi his phone. Chi noticed that she'd been crying, and that she noticed him noticing. She reached into her purse for a tissue, wiped her eyes, and put the tissue in her pocket.
C.S., he wants to hear about my arm. I'd like to tell him now, and then Chi can leave and we can work.
C.S. nodded. Do you want to talk in private?
No, you and Herbert are part of the story.
She turned to Chi.
Let's sit over there.
She twisted a lock of her hair.
After I tell you, will you tell Mama?
It depends.
How about Sister? Will you tell her?
Chi nodded yes. I don't think secrets are good for a relationship. Do you?
It depends. Sometimes a secret keeps somebody from a broken heart.
He thought about that, remembering Leaphorn's advice. If the person finds out later, and they usually do, the heartbreak is twice as bad. Keeping a secret means you don't trust or love somebody enough to tell them the truth. He saw her blinking back the tears and felt a wave of sympathy for her. Just tell me, and I'll decide after that. Darlene rolled up her sleeve. The bruise had turned dull yellow at the edges, but still resembled nothing more closely than the grip of a hand.
C.S. did grab me, just like you guessed, but he had to. He and me in London and Herbert went to a party, and there was beer, the high-octane kind, in the cooler. C.S. brought me a Sprite or something in one of those sleeve things. I poured it out and helped myself to a beer, and then two or three more using that sleeve thing, you know, so no one would be on my case about it. It was only beer, bro.
She stopped. Chi watched her fidget. Tell me the rest.
Well, I was acting real cool, talking to some other kids in the program. And then C.S. came over and said he had to get back to work. He smelled the beer on me and got all bent out of shape. He told me...
She swallowed, and she saw her struggle to control her emotions.
What did he tell you?
He said I was immature, that I'd never be a real artist because I didn't have any discipline. I told him he was a stupid, controlling jackass, and then...
He saw the corners of her mouth slope down, and her bottom lip begin to tremble.
And then C.S. hurt you?
No, not at all. Then Herbert came over and put his arm around C.S. and took him into the other room. I was crying, and then I decided that I hated both those jerks, and I was going to just get out of there.
She stopped talking. Darlene twisted a different lock of hair.
Well, instead of leaving, I thought I'd have another beer to calm myself down. After that, I was acting crazy, like dancing around. Maybe half an hour went by, and C.S. found me again and wanted to get me out of there. There were some steps, and I was yelling at him to leave me alone, and I missed a step, or maybe two, or... I don't exactly remember. He caught my arm right before I fell. He had to grab hard.
Darlene looked down at her shoes.
Herbert helped me get into the car. He told me to behave myself.
She let her story sit for a moment.
What do you think about all that?
I drank too much, and then I acted like a jerk. C.S. and Herbert were good to me.
She thought he should say something wise, give her some advice about turning her life around, but he'd already said it, already told her. As she repeatedly reminded him, she was old enough to make her own choices and deal with the consequences. Darlene looked at him.
You know I like drinking because it makes me feel free, not like a dumb girl. But then I act like a dumb girl.
She saw the tears now.
I only want to be happy and do my art, and for people to trust me. But when they do, when they give me a chance, like Mama and Sister did, I screw up.
Herbert had been sitting next to the studio door, listening, and she knew, observing him and Darlene. Now he stood and walked toward them. He looked at she.
Mind if I give this lady some advice?
Go ahead. Herbert squatted next to her.
Honey, you don't want to end up like Juanita. You've got a lot of talent. Don't let booze get in the way. You know that drawing you gave me?
Yes.
Every time I look at it, I'm gonna think of you as an artist. You'll go far if you put your energy there. Don't get sidetracked with partying, or you won't be able to be an artist.
She said, thanks for telling me the truth. I won't lie to Bernie, but I won't mention this to her unless she asks, or unless you want me to tell her.
Really?
Darlene was crying now.
But tell her I fixed your flat, okay? I could do that because of what she taught me about cars.
You fixed it? For real?
Exactly. That's why I was so late.
17. Officer Bernadette Manuelito drove out of the search and rescue base camp parking area, headed back to New Mexico 117, and then to the interstate, and ultimately, home to Shiprock. She enjoyed this highway, with the acres of dark lava on one side and the wind-carved sandstone cliffs on the other, a respite before she hit the truck traffic on the interstate. She needed time to think about Cruz, the spirals, and how this all fit with Counselor Walker's suspicions. As she slowed for three does bounding across the highway, she spotted a vehicle that had run off the road and into a fence post or guardrail. The rear end rose from the incline of the shoulder, and exhaust from the running engine created a cloud of gray. Because of the angle of the embankment, she couldn't see the front of the car. Pulling to the side of the road behind the vehicle, she parked and turned on her light bar, took her first aid kit out of the trunk, and zipped her jacket. She jogged to the car, passing several miniature liquor bottles strewn along the shoulder. Another drunk driving crash? Or were they older debris from passing motorists? As she got closer, she recognized the El Moro bumper sticker. This car belonged to Larry Hoffman, the ranger she'd spoken to about the lava stories.
Peering in the back, she saw a figure slouched over the steering wheel. She scrambled down the rock slope and rapped on the driver's side window. The bloodied man behind the steering wheel opened his eyes and looked up at her without recognition. The airbag had deployed, probably on impact with the guardrail. Hoffman was wearing his seatbelt. He was the only person in the car.
"Turn off the engine, Larry," she yelled.
He fumbled with the switches and eventually lowered the passenger's side window. She walked around the rear of the car down the slope and reached in to turn off the engine. Except for a nosebleed, she didn't see any other injuries, and he seemed to be breathing without difficulty.
"Hey, I know you. You're that Navajo cop, Bernalito Manuel, right?"
She didn't hear the telltale slur that came with too much drink, but something was wrong.
"Cop is right. I'm Bernadette Manuelito."
"Bernadette. Hey, that's it."
When he chuckled, she sniffed for the sweet chemical smell of alcohol. There was none. No marijuana aroma either.
"Help me out of the car, okay, honey? There are too many ants in here."
She called 911 from her cell phone and gave the dispatcher the closest mile marker sign to the accident. "My unit is on the shoulder with the lights on. The car is to the right of that. The driver is the only injury. He's conscious and not complaining of pain, but he has a nosebleed and is hallucinating." She leaned in closer to Larry. She didn't see any liquor bottles or drugs. No ants either.
"Sit tight. An ambulance is on the way. I'll stay here with you until it gets here."
"Where'd all this blood come from?"
"The airbag whacked you in the face when it went off."
"Wow. It felt like a frozen cloud. Debbie, be careful leaning on the car. You don't want the ants to get on you. They've been friendly so far. Some of them are singing to me. The ones that are by my ear. Don't let them crawl in, okay?"
He attempted a grin, but it transformed into a grimace. She looked at both his ears. No ants. Not that she had expected to see any in December. Had he taken some sort of hallucinogenic drug?
"Try to stay still, sir," she said. "Have you had a beer or something else alcoholic to drink?"
"Only a little. I've always been a little trippy, but not on purpose, Debolito."
His laugh ended in a wince.
"My back was giving me fits. A swig or two makes the painkillers work better, but now I can't see very well."
"Your glasses broke. That's part of the trouble."
The impact had smashed Larry's glasses and, from the looks of it, fractured his nose.
"Why did you crash down here?"
"Crashed!"
He roared out the word, then stopped and looked at her as if he'd completed the sentence.
"The phone figured out who called when the road swerved. Can you get me out of here?"
Far down the highway, Bernie could see the lights of the approaching ambulance. "I can't, so just try to relax. The medics will be here soon, and they'll help you. They can do it without making anything hurt worse."
"My right arm doesn't want to go anywhere."
She glanced at his right shoulder, which sat at the odd angle that usually meant a dislocation.
"Does it hurt?"
"Not unless I try to move it."
He demonstrated, grimacing with pain.
"You're nice to stop to help me. Ms. Officer, could you do me a favor?"
"What is it?"
She hoped it didn't involve the imaginary ants. He swiveled his upper body, trying to look toward the back seat.
"Youch! My wings are crushed."
"Your wings?"
"Yeah. Can you see if anything broke in the back seat?"
A brown box sealed with tape lay on the floor behind the front seat.
"The carton slipped off onto the floor, but it doesn't look damaged. What's in it?"
"A beautiful pot."
He motioned toward the floor of the passenger seat with his left hand.
"Could you use that? I called her when I left the office, so push that little wart, and there you have it."
She walked around the car again and opened the passenger's side door, looking for a phone. By lifting the floor mat, she finally found it, wedged between the mat and the doorframe. She replaced the mat smoothly on the clean floor beneath it, and then checked the last call. Merrily Cruz?
Good-looking woman, huh? I told her I'd bring back her pot, but I can't leave the ants. Could you tell her what happened?
I'll dial, and then you can talk. Bernie punched the green button to place the call, put the phone on speaker, and held it near Hoffman's mouth. Merrily didn't even say hello.
Where are you? I've got a million things to do besides wait around for your lazy carcass.
The man didn't respond.
You agreed to have it here in half an hour.
I'm trapped in my car, and there's a problem with blood.
What? Larry, you're scaring me. What's going on out there?
You talk, he mouthed to Bernie and turned his head away.
Merrily, it's Officer Manuelito. Ranger Hoffman had a car accident. I'm here with him now, waiting for the ambulance. The phone went quiet for a long moment. When Merrily spoke again, her voice had changed.
Oh, dear. How bad is he?
I don't know. I can hear the ambulance rolling toward us now. Let the paramedics examine him, she thought, and then Hoffman can tell her his condition if he wants to.
Good. Is Manzanares there, too?
An odd question, Bernie thought.
No, ma'am. She looked toward the white pickup as it rolled to a stop. Merrily hung up without a goodbye. Bernie offered the phone to Hoffman, and he tossed it toward the passenger seat. He didn't react when the phone bounced from the seat onto the floor.
So will you, he said.
Will I what?
That box.
She could see him struggle to find the words.
If my house rolls away, something might happen, you know?
You mean when your car is towed, the box might disappear? Hoffman pointed over his shoulder into the back seat.
For Mamarily. My flavor, please. Remember.
She recalled the book he'd sold her at a bargain price. The gift still sat in the trunk of her unit, awaiting Chi's return and their reunion. She took out her phone and took a picture of the box as it rested on the back seat floor, and a close-up that showed the address on it, that of Merrily Cruz. Then she lifted it out of the back seat, put it in the trunk of her unit, took another picture, and came back to keep an eye on Hoffman. Some minutes later, the ambulance crew members jumped out, unloaded their stretcher, and headed toward the car. Bernie felt relief course through her. Hoffman would be in good hands. Two attendants began helping Hoffman while the third spoke to her.
Did you see what happened?
He asked. No, I noticed the car as I was driving by. She paused as a pickup pulled off on the shoulder and parked in front of her unit. His right shoulder looks like it might be dislocated, and his nose is at a funny angle and bleeding. He's hallucinating, and his glasses broke.
Is he drunk?
He told me he'd had a drink and some painkillers. He isn't combative.
Anything else?
His name is Larry Hoffman, and he's a ranger at El Morro. The medic thanked her. As she headed back toward her unit, she saw Manzanares, out of uniform, walking down the slope from the white pickup toward the accident. He stopped when he reached her.
What happened?
Hoffman said a phone call distracted him and he ran off the road. He nodded.
Clear road, no traffic. How badly injured is he?
You'll have to ask the ambulance crew. It looks to me like a broken nose and a dislocated shoulder. I don't know what else.
At least he didn't hurt anybody else. If you hadn't been out here, it would have taken a while for someone to find him, especially now that it's getting dark.
Manzanares sighed.
Dumb bastard. Why are you here?
She resented the attitude that went with the question. I was checking out some old bones at the rescue site, and I saw a car off the road. She'd used the wrong word, she realized. Cruz had not been rescued yet. Have you heard how much longer the search will go on?
I don't know, but the team is running out of places to look, and a big storm is on the way.
Why did it take so long for the search to get started?
What do you mean?
You showed up and made the call, and then at least 2 hours before anything happened, before cats arrived and got things moving.
You know how ladies are.
I do. Efficient and professional. Kat said she was on the road within 15 minutes of getting the call.
Well then, it's a mystery, isn't it? Kind of like Cruz disappearing out here in the first place.
Manzanares turned his back on her and started down the hill. As Bernie climbed up the slope to her police car, she glared at the Dallas Cowboys bumper sticker on his truck, another point against the man. She liked the Broncos. She started the engine and finally headed for Shiprock. The highway was dark now, and only one vehicle passed her. She enjoyed this ride in the daytime, but now, especially after the hike to see the bones and the excitement of Larry's accident, she wanted to be home. Snow fell lightly now, and she turned on the wipers. At the junction with I-40, she hesitated, deciding that she had enough fuel to wait until the truck stop west of Grant's. She would stretch and get some coffee, shake off the weariness she felt. From there, it was about 2 hours to Shiprock. She heard her phone vibrate. She? No, it was Manzanares.
Larry Hoffman is in the intensive care unit. Did he talk to you about a box that was in the back seat?
Yes, he said it was an old pot and asked me to take it to Merrily Cruz for him. I said I would because he was so concerned about it disappearing when his car was towed.
He played you. Bad move. I found pills in a baggie under the front passenger's side floor mat. I don't think there is a pot in that box. Or if there is, it's probably packed with drugs. What were you thinking, sweetheart?
His condescending attitude made her bristle. Are you sure about the baggie? Bernie remembered lifting the mat and replacing it. It had fit snugly, with nothing hidden beneath it.
Of course I'm sure.
Manzanares spoke with a sneer.
I didn't find a phone in the car or on him. Did you take that too?
I saw him try to toss it on the passenger seat. It bounced to the floor.
Well, don't worry about the phone. It's not your case or your jurisdiction, and I know you've got plenty to do. I'll talk to Merrily Cruz about the box and handle this.
And he ended the call. She drove on, her earlier sluggishness evaporated in the heat of Manzanares's lies. Her brain, which had been puzzling over Cruz's disappearance ever since she received Cooper's worried call, grasped some rough edges that gave her purchase on the problem at hand. She hadn't missed the drugs. They hadn't been there when she searched. That could only mean one thing. Manzanares had planted them for some reason. Her next stop was Merrily's house. She would open the box in the woman's presence. If there were drugs in it, she'd take photos. If not, she'd ask some questions about how the pot was acquired, and exactly what the internet art business was, and see where the conversation went from there. Hoffman had referred to the pot as her pot. Did that mean Merrily had purchased it from the museum shop? What if, instead, he'd had the pot on consignment there from Merrily? By all accounts, Domingo Cruz knew the Malpais, and he hiked with his camera. What if he'd stumbled across some burials, caves of bones such as Annie had found, but with grave goods intact? It would be easy for him to photograph them as he found them, and then Merrily could market them on the internet, or Larry Hoffman could sell them under the counter at the monument store, preferably to visitors like the French people she met, or others who didn't know or care enough about the antiquities law protecting cultural resources to ask how they happened to be at the gift shop. The more she thought about the pot in the trunk of her unit, the more questions she had. No lights were on in Merrily's house, and there was no vehicle in the driveway. She rang the doorbell, and when there was no answer, rapped with the big metal knocker. As she waited in the dark, snow began to fall in earnest, melting as it touched the ground. The temperature had dropped, too. Her mind scrolled back to her encounter with Manzanares at the accident scene. He hadn't asked her to give him the box, or even to leave it at the police station for him. That reinforced her idea that the issue wasn't drugs in the box with the pot, but the pot itself. One of the searchers had mentioned that the Manzanares family ranch bordered public land. Had Dom taken the pot from the ranch? An old pot found on private land could be legally resold if it wasn't associated with a burial. One from the Malpais, with its collection of federal agency jurisdictions, was off-limits, as was anything associated with the dead. Did any of this explain why Domingo Cruz was missing? Was Marilee propping up Wings and Roots with her internet sales? Bernie rapped again and called for Marilee, then took an official Navajo police business card out of her backpack. On the blank side, she wrote, "Call me about Larry's box." As she walked back to her unit, she looked over at the greenhouse, a building about the size of a two-car garage. The lights were on, creating a warm glow. Maybe Marilee was there. Bernie opened the waist-high garden gate and walked toward the greenhouse along a path illuminated with small solar lights. Heat and moisture had steamed up the glass, but she could discern tree-like shapes, faintly green through the opaqueness. She rapped on the door.
"Marilee, it's Bernie Manuelito. Are you in there?"
She waited, then tried the doorknob. It turned, and she entered. It took a minute for the loamy perfume to reach her, and for her to feel the warmth and humidity. The raised beds were empty, their dark soil resting from whatever crop they had held. Large pots held rosemary, and small trees bearing aromatic white blossoms and small little oranges among the shiny leaves. Some ficus trees had yellow leaves along with the green, as she would have expected in December. Stick-like dormant plants waited for the welcome warmth and light of spring. On the wall was a timer, evidently the device that controlled the watering and the light system for the greenhouse. But no Marilee. A heady fragrance drew her to the Brugmansia. One plant, its showy yellow trumpet flowers as big as soup bowls, was fully in bloom, giving off a rich, deep perfume. Rubber gloves lay next to the plant's pot, a reminder that, like many beautiful things that grow in gardens and greenhouses, Brugmansia are potentially toxic. Bernie looked around once more, and then went back into the chilly night air, closing the greenhouse door tightly against animal intruders and the cold before she hurried down the lit path to her unit. The fresh air cleared her brain after the heavy scent of the beautiful Brugs. As she drove out of the neighborhood, a dark vehicle passed her, headed in the opposite direction. She slowed, thinking it might be Marilee, but it wasn't the Mercedes she'd seen in the driveway on her first visit, but an older truck. As she watched the vehicle in her rearview mirror, it made a U-turn. The driver flashed the headlights at her and honked. She pulled to the side of the road, and the other driver stopped next to her and lowered the window. She lowered hers, too.
"Franklin, what are you doing out here?"
"Officer Manuelito, hi. I was looking for Marilee, same as you, I guess. I heard some terrible news, and I thought, well, if she didn't know, I'd break it to her."
"What?"
He brushed the snow off the truck's window frame.
"These flakes are the forerunners of a huge storm. If things are as bad as the Weather Service predicts, they'll be calling off the search tomorrow."
"I'm sorry to hear that."
"I thought Marilee might be able to do something since she's a blood relative. It's not right, you know."
His voice began to crack.
"It's just not."
Bernie turned her heater up a notch. "I was out there today with the searchers, and they looked exhausted. A break might give them more energy and ideas."
Franklin pulled a blue knit cap tighter over his ears.
"I guess I can't blame them. I mean, they don't even know Dom, and they are leaving their own families at home to help find him, and the weather will make all of it more dangerous. But I hate to think of him out there in the cold, in the snow. I mean, if he's conscious, if he's still alive somehow, or even if he's dead, his poor body."
He stopped and sighed.
I'm babbling. I wasn't prepared. I wasn't expecting.
I could use something to eat before I drive home, Bernie broke in. I don't know Grant's very well. She thought about suggesting a fast food place. They'd have burgers for sure, but the generic anonymity did not seem an appropriate setting in which to deal with fresh grief. She mentioned the only place she'd tried that wasn't fast food, First Street Cafe, with its view of the mountains. Franklin nodded.
I like that place, but they don't serve dinner. I know a good family-run New Mexican spot, El Cafecito.
Do they have hamburgers?
Probably so. Dom and I always get the New Mexican specials.
The restaurant featured whimsical metal lizards on the walls and smelled of simmering chili sauce. Despite Franklin's enthusiastic recommendation of chili rellenos and sopaipillas, Bernie ordered a Coke and a burger and bought coffee for Franklin, who protested that he wasn't hungry. He added 3 sugars to his cup, but barely touched it. Under the restaurant's bright lights, his nails looked ragged, and there were dark circles under his eyes. Have you slept since Tom disappeared? He shook his head.
Every time I'm about to nod off, I think of him. And I wonder if he's cold, if he's hungry, desperate for water, you know.
I wish I had met him. Tell me about him. Franklin talked as she ate. He reinforced what she already knew. Domingo Cruz was both nervous and excited about the opportunity to become director of the Wings and Roots, but he hadn't made a firm decision yet. If he took the job, Franklin explained, he'd miss the direct work with the kids, but he wanted to make sure the organization continued.
I believe he'll stay, because he thinks the best way to solve the problem is to become the director.
What's the problem?
Dom didn't talk specifics, but I know they need money. Every non-profit group in the country is hurting because of the economy. Dom always pushed for Wings and Roots to work with all the students who need the help, not only the ones whose parents can afford the price. Sometimes if a student wanted to be part of the program and her relatives couldn't pay, he'd contribute the tuition. All quietly, of course. He didn't want any attention.
Franklin shifted onto one hip and pulled a handkerchief out of his back pocket to blow his nose.
I told him he couldn't afford to do it, but he said he'd get by, and he always did.
How much does he give?
He put in $300 once.
Franklin chuckled.
We ate a lot of beans that month.
Bernie put her burger down. I saw some of his photos at Merrily's house. They are beautiful.
He got interested in photography as part of a teacher training program he took at the New Mexico State University Branch College here. He uses a camera, not a cell phone, to take photos. He's excited about the book he and his sister are working on, a collection of some of his pictures. Even though he was exhausted, he'd stay behind after every trip to the Malpais to get some shots. When Merrily told him she was having trouble coming up with money for publication, he stopped for a while and fell into a funk. He went back to taking photographs this fall, and it seemed to lift his spirits.
Does he specialize in petroglyphs?
No, but he likes to take pictures of them. He said it was interesting to see how they almost disappeared, depending on the light. He said the idea of standing where the ancient ones had stood when they made the drawings gave him a great appreciation for the past.
Did he ever mention anything about graves?
No, not to me. We don't talk about that kind of stuff. I think the dead should be left alone.
Agreed. Bernie sipped her Coke. Did Dom share that view?
Dom doesn't spend much energy thinking about the ones who have left us. He focuses on the future. That's why he loves working with kids. When we'd argue about something, he used to say that the past is the past and we can't change it. If we want a better future, we have to work with the present.
Franklin looked at his coffee cup.
He always tells me to make each day count and consider it a gift. I had to remind him of that when he was feeling down about the agency and all the debt.
Watching Franklin's throat vibrate as he swallowed, she gave him time to rein in his emotions.
Do you think Dom could have been mixed up in something dangerous?
Dangerous? Just being out there was dangerous. Other than that, no.
I'm just trying to consider all possibilities. Bernie took the last bite of her burger. They sat quietly, like old friends, and she watched the waitress clear a table across the room. The restaurant was nearly empty. Closing time. Franklin broke the silence.
When Dom and I first met, he took me for a hike out there in the lava field. It was late April. He showed me some petroglyphs and said they had probably been left by the relatives of someone from Acoma or Zuni. We ate lunch and listened to the wind. He told me that was his special place, where he always felt peaceful.
I felt safe with him.
Wherever he was when I was with him, it was my special place. We'd come out here on weekends and stay in my little house in San Rafael. Without him, if he's gone, I don't have a safe place. They can't stop the search and leave him out there tonight.
Franklin bolted to standing. Bernie put her hand on his arm.
I can call Katz right now, and you can tell her what you know about how to find that place. If they haven't already looked there, they...
Franklin pulled away. With one quick motion, he zipped his jacket and tossed a $5 bill on the table.
Wait for me to pay, and...
Bernie stopped. He'd already run to the door and disappeared into the night. 18. Bernie hurried into her coat, leaving her last 20 for the meal and the tip. She couldn't wait for change. By the time she reached the parking lot, Franklin was gone. The taillights of his truck, red beacons growing smaller in the falling snow. As she ran for her unit, she watched him turn left onto Grant's main street, toward the on-ramps to Interstate 40 and, beyond that, the eastern side of the Malpais. As she put her backpack on the seat, Bernie felt her cell phone vibrate. Mama, Darlene, Leaphorn, even she, whoever it was, would have to wait. She clicked on her seatbelt, started the engine, and radioed the local law enforcement that she was in pursuit of a distraught Navajo man driving a black Ford pickup.
You're aware of the weather conditions?
Yes, that's part of my concern. She gave the dispatcher Franklin's name and description.
You know about the ongoing search out there for the missing person?
Yes.
Be careful. Make sure they don't end up looking for you, too.
Her first judgment call came as she neared the freeway entrance. She could get on I-40 West here, head toward Gallup, and then get off at the San Rafael exit, which accessed the west side of the Malpais and also was closer to the house Franklin and Cruz shared in San Rafael on weekends. But her instincts told her to keep going straight toward the Badlands, straight to the area where the search for Cruz was based. The bridge over the freeway had started to ice, but it wasn't slick yet. Traffic on the interstate was surprisingly heavy. The storm must have caught the truckers off guard. Snow had accumulated on the edges of the highway, but the paved roadway was wet, not icy, at least not yet. She experimented with increasing her speed until she found the right level, as fast as possible without undue risk. The wipers set a steady rhythm for her thoughts, and did a decent job of clearing the swirl of rapidly falling snow. She should never have mentioned suicide to Franklin. He was partially unglued already, judging not only by his unkempt looks, but by his tears and impulsiveness. His mental stability had been hanging by a thread, and her questions might have taken him to a dark place. She'd spent too many nights talking to cops, she decided. She knew that words had consequences. That was why the holy people had taught the Navajo to use them wisely and with restraint. Talking about the negative, as she had done, brought it into the forefront, like inviting evil into the hogan, into your living room. She was only talking, not thinking. Talking too much, a little too proud, a little too full of herself. All behaviors the holy people warned against.
The snow came down more heavily now, fast enough that her wipers struggled to keep the windshield clean. A slick spot on the highway slid her unit across the yellow shoulder line. She automatically took her foot off the gas, eased back into the proper lane, and focused her full attention.